So I find these introductions quite helpful. But it always repays going back to the text and just checking back through it. Don't assume that because it's kind of in graphic mode and somebody knows a bit more than you do, that it's always exactly right. And actually, as I read back through Obadiah and actually read back through that bit of Amos that it referred to there, contrary to what the Bible Project people say, I didn't find this a very hopeful book at all. As they have described, Edom took advantage of Judah when they were on the floor, and it's never nice to kick a man when he's down. And this is a prophecy about Edom getting its comeuppance. So I've chosen a few verses from it. They're on the screen, so if you bring those up now, we'll just read these verses through together. So verse 4, and then we'll jump and so on. Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Egypt? You will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountain will be cut down in the slaughter. Because of your violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. Carry on. You should not have gloated over your brother in his misfortune, nor rejoiced over the people of Judah at their destruction, nor boasted so much at the time of their trouble. You should not have marched through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloated over them in their calamity, nor seized their wealth. You should not have waited at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor handed over their survivors in the day of their trouble. Next slide. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. Jacob will be a fire and Joseph a flame. Esau will be stubble. The Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad will possess the towns of the Negev. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau. Now, those are particularly strong words. And anybody who takes an interest in the Bible will need to pick their way through some of the Old Testament themes. When you come to the New Testament, you know that the New Testament often quotes the Old Testament. It doesn't quote all of the Old Testament. You'll find that when Jesus quotes the Old Testament, he often quotes from Deuteronomy, he often quotes from Isaiah. But there are other places where you think he might quote from, and he doesn't. And he doesn't reinforce some of the ideas and themes that run through. And Obadiah doesn't get quoted at all. It's important to remember that God is the God of the whole world, as we've been told, and the arrogant will be cut down to size. But what is slightly disturbing is that there's a kind of them and us thing going on in Obadiah. Them, Edom, the descendants of Esau, is evil, whereas us, Judah, the descendants of Jacob, is good. It's that kind of theme. Surely God is more discerning than that. Surely God knows that there is good and evil in all of us. And the mystery of iniquity, as one early Baptist described it, is deeply rooted in each one of us. So Obadiah's prophecy was always in danger of arousing Jewish nationalism, that the problem is over there beyond the border. It's those nations around us. And when prophets came along to denounce those nations, that made the people of Israel pleased. Whereas Amos was not a popular prophet because he criticized God's people, Obadiah would have been because he tapped into that kind of jingoism that sees the problem as being out there and not in here. And therefore, as you reflect on Obadiah, the message is quite straightforward when you read it. It's about a nation getting their comeuppance. But as you read it, you need to read it not thinly, but reflectively. I come across so many Christians who say, I'm not into head knowledge, I'm into heart knowledge. Now, that's a kind of, sometimes I think that's a bit of an excuse for not being prepared to get deep down into the Bible and to think about what it actually says. My mum and Lois's mum did the same thing. Whenever they went to the doctor, they come back afterwards and we'd say to them, how did you get on? And they'd say the same thing. They'd say, the doctor was pleased with me. Have you ever heard that said before? And we said, well, what did he say though? What did he say was wrong with you? You know, what's the diagnosis? What's the prognosis? You know, how's this thing going to work out? Do you need me to? All you get was, he was pleased with me. It's a kind of thin approach to things. And you need to kind of get into the detail. And there are some questions that you need to ask of the Bible if you're to kind of get the best out of it. And so often people drift back into this experience of thinking, I can't be doing with the head stuff, you know. I just like to have my heart touched. That's not good enough. It's not going to get you through life. And when people ask you the hard questions in life, you won't have things to say to them. So one of the difficult questions you have to ask about the Old Testament is this. Were books included in the canon of 39 books because they were inspired or because they were popular? Were the Jews who made the decision inspired, or did they belong to a particular brand of Judaism, which was actually a twisted version of the truth? I'm not giving you the answer, I'm asking you a question. Because if you want to move beyond Sunday school Christianity to a more scholarly, critical reading of the Bible, these are questions that you have to ask. You read Ezra. Ezra to the Jews is the second most important Jew in their history behind Moses. Not Abraham, not David, not Elijah, Elisha, any of those. Ezra is up there second because he brought the law back to the people. And yet when you read Ezra, you read a very thin, unsettling kind of racism that Ezra was promulgating. And that's disturbing when you read it. Was that inspired or was that simply popular? You read Chronicles. I don't know how many of you ever bother to read Chronicles. It's that in the Jewish scriptures, it's the last of the books. In the Christian Old Testament, it's in the middle. Same books, but in a kind of different order. And usually when I come talk to Christians about Chronicles, they'll know about the prayer of Jabez, because that got made very popular about 20 years ago by somebody who wrote a book in America about expanding his frontiers. And also that verse, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray, then will I hear from heaven and heal their land. Christians always know those two things, but you ask them any other thing about Chronicles and they don't know. But if you read the book, it's a retelling of Jewish history, and it kind of takes Samuel and it takes Kings and it takes some other bits as well. And you will find as you read it that you find yourself thinking, this history has been airbrushed. David, from being a flawed man, has turned into a perfect, obedient man. Solomon, from being a very flawed man, has turned into a great guy because he built the temple. And it's not even in the case of Obadiah that Obadiah was wrong. I'm not disagreeing with his telling of history. It's about how his words would have been received and used by other people that worries me. Do you remember Enoch Powell back in 1968? Many of you will do. That famous rivers of blood speech. It seemed to give permission to racism in this country. Within two or three days, people from the north of England were marching down, demanding an end to immigration. What he actually said at a Conservative Party meeting, it wasn't in the House of Commons or anything, was that he was simply concerned about the volume of immigration happening at the time. But what people heard was something really quite different. Do you remember Ian Paisley? Whenever Ian Paisley was out speaking, he would be thumping a drum and he would be raising his voice and shouting. And the message he gave was very anti-Republican. And on one occasion, they interviewed somebody from Northern Ireland who had become a paramilitary. And they said, why did you do that? Why did you spend time in prison? He killed Republicans. They said, why did you do that? He said, I was inspired to do it by Ian Paisley. They went to Ian Paisley and said, did you realize that you inspired people to be paramilitaries? You were Christian. He said, they misunderstood what I was saying. You have to be so careful what you say. And therefore, I'm suggesting to you that when you read Obadiah, you need to be careful how you read it. Supposing the boot had been on the other foot, supposing Edom had been down and then Judah had been putting the boot in, What would the prophet have said then? Actually, might have been reversed. But because it's the way it is, we as Christians tend to rule out the house of Jacob and Edom and say they were terrible people, but Israel can do no wrong. And for that matter, as you begin to think about Obadiah in the present day, you can't but ignore what's happening in modern Jewish history. You can hardly ignore the Arab-Israeli war in the late 1940s when Israel jumped the gun and began to seize land in Palestine. For some years before that, the United Nations had been working on a partition plan for how the land could be shared between Jews and Palestinians. But then in 1948, Israel charged in and took more than it should have in the plan. In the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel took full control of the whole region, only to bow to international pressure and to hand some of it back again. And ever since then, as you all know, there have been deep tensions between Jews and Palestinians. And if you've never read beyond Genesis 12, you'll probably assume that this is part of the divine plan and that Christians should stand uncritically with Israel. But the truth is that there have been atrocities on both sides. Israel has blocked aid to Gaza, ostensibly to stop munitions being smuggled in. Different groups of extremist Muslims, Hamas, a Sunni group, and Hezbollah, a Shia group, have been firing their rockets into Israel. And the list of casualties keeps being written. In Obadiah's language, there has been arrogance and callousness and evil on both sides of that divide. So that when God Channel preachers pledge their money and support for Israel, I get annoyed. It's not because I'm pro-Palestinian, but more because I believe the God of the Bible wants even-handedness, and he's a God who has a morality attached to him. Or look at the Labour Party at the moment. Ken Livingstone delights in pointing out that the Nazis were Zionists, which is bound to offend Jews, really. But now Jeremy Corbyn is the target because in his pre-leader days, he seemed to be in the Palestinian corner. And we're now being told that if you're anti-Zionist, you're also anti-Semite. So what is an anti-Zionist? Well, apparently it's someone who is opposed to the state of Israel. But I haven't met anybody like that. People I speak to are happy for the Jews to have part of the land, and that's not a problem, but not all of it. And yet that subtlety gets lost as accusations of anti-Semitism get bandied around. So often in our conversations, the analysis is thin. It's a kind of them and us theology that comes through. It lacks moral integrity. As I was preparing for this, I was thinking about a few friends of ours from the past who had been married and at various points very happily married, and then things had gone wrong in their relationships and it led to separation and eventually to divorce. And both of them were our friends. And we wanted to keep in touch with both of them. But it actually became quite difficult because if you spoke to him, then she would be really quite upset with you and say, well, what did he say? And how did he twist it? You know, because actually you need to listen to me. I'll tell you what the truth is. And when you spoke to him, he said, well, she says that, but you have to remember this, this and that. And what I found was that it was a kind of them and us thing, that they would want you to take sides, and I don't want you to speak to him because you're my friend only now. You can't be friends with him anymore. I don't know if you've ever encountered that in divorce, but it's very often a situation where you want to recognise that probably there are faults on both sides and maybe more on one side than another, but you want to retain the friendship and you want to have integrity about how you deal with it. We are New Testament people, followers of Jesus, called to be more nuanced in our analysis of the world, and certainly called to be moral in our analysis. If Moses' brief encounter with the Pharaoh was about getting God's people out of Egypt, Moses would soon discover that the bigger challenge would be getting Egypt out of God's people. Where Ezra simplistically blamed the shortcomings of the nation on the presence of foreign wives, Jesus came to save his people from their sins. Because Jesus knew how things can change. The situation in Obadiah 100 years later
might be very different. Whereas Egypt had been the great oppressor in the days of Moses with his slaughter of the innocents, by the time Jesus was a toddler, it was the Jewish king Herod who was the oppressor, repeating the same massacre on the small children of Bethlehem. But note that when Jesus' family fled, Egypt was now the place of refuge. Just as Daniel Ortega has moved from being the liberator of Nicaragua 40 years ago to being its tyrant now, so the target of Obadiah's message may change from generation to generation. So I despair of some Christian propaganda that goes around. Jerry Falwell, back in 1981, said this: "To stand against Israel is to stand against God. We believe that history and scripture prove that God deals with nations in relation to how they deal with Israel." I don't believe that. I simply do not believe that. Jesus had so little interest in land, which is what the whole Israel-Palestine thing is about, and so much more interest in values. He predicted the fall of Jerusalem, the price the Jews would pay for the rejection of the Messiah. Jesus would say, "Foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to rest his head." He was not interested in land, but on the cross, in an act of supreme sacrifice and mercy, he did finally rest his head and die. If, as I suggest, Obadiah doesn't offer us much in the way of hope, he does unwittingly call us to beware. Beware of pointing the finger or becoming the monster that you once despised. Beware of taking sides in disputes that are so much more complicated than you realize. Beware of nationalism. Beware of tribalism. Beware of pointing out the speck in someone else's eye when there's a great big plank in your own. Beware of too hastily singing, "I love you, Lord," when you despise your brother or sister. For the proud and self-righteous will be humbled, and it's the poor in spirit who will inherit the earth. A more critical reading of Scripture doesn't weaken your heart. It may multiply your questions, but it strengthens your faith and it deepens your wisdom and it nourishes your soul. And I hope you'll make the journey. In October, as you'll see on the news sheet, we are beginning some second Sundays round at the Mount next door to talk through difficult issues. And it's meant to be a reactive thing where you can come along and say, "There's this bit about the Bible I've never really understood," so that we can talk through some of those things. And if you want to do some serious reading, you could do a lot worse than this book here, Reverberations of Faith. It takes 109 different themes from the Old Testament and just a couple of pages on each one, so you can pick it up at breakfast and read it through. You will find it will enrich your faith and clarify how your Christian faith really relates to the world in the process. So ask me afterwards if you want to know where to get that, or I can get you a copy quite easily. So let's bow our heads in prayer together, shall we?